Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Alexander McCall Smith, whose latest novel is The Kalahari Typing School for Men. This is part of a series of books. This is the fourth book in the series of the number one ladies' detective agency, which is actually the name of the first book in the series. Alexander McCall Smith is a professor of medical law at Edinburgh University, founded the law school in Botswana.
Yes.
Has published several books of various sorts, including a legal textbook on Botswanan law.
Yes, with a colleague in Botswana. I wrote a book called The Criminal Law of Botswana.
These four books also represent something which has been going on in publishing for a long time, but which the publishing industry in America seems to completely ignore, the fact that popular books are found. They're not created by a bunch of PR people, because these books were published by a small press, Polygon, in Edinburgh, in Scotland, and gradually became popular, much, I guess, in a similar way as the J.K. Rowling books began.
Yes, it's rather an interesting story. I certainly found it very interesting in that the first book in the series, The Number One Ladies Detective Agency, was published by, as you say, a small publisher in Scotland, a very small publisher in Scotland, and I remember their saying that they thought they might put the boat out on this one and do a print run of 2,000 copies, which was very adventurous for them. So it had very small beginnings. And then I wrote a sequel after we'd had some generous reviews, but it was still very small, and it remained small until such time as it was distributed in the United States by Columbia University Press, who got it into the independent bookstores. So it really, that was the factor which got it going. The independent booksellers hand-sold it, as they say. They recommended it, and it started popping up on local bestseller lists, for example, in the Boston area. And I think when that happened, it began to snowball, and then eventually the big publishers in New York became interested in it. And we ended up with Anchor Books, which is part of the Random House group, and they've been very, very supportive and very fine publishers to be with, and they've done a wonderful job with it. But as you say, it's growing a book from a very small seed.
When you first wrote The Number One Ladies Detective Agency, what prompted you to write it beyond the fact that you saw a woman wringing a chicken's neck?
Yes. Well, I had lived in Botswana, as you say, and I had thought that one of these days I would write about a person in Botswana, and I thought perhaps write about a Botswana woman, because I'd had this extraordinary experience where I saw this remarkable woman chasing a chicken round her yard and then catching it. And that stuck in my mind, and I thought this was a very organized and competent woman, and I might write about somebody like her. So I hadn't, at that stage, any plans to write about a detective agency, and I think it was just by coincidence that the character about whom I eventually wrote ended up having a detective agency. I don't regard myself as a writer of detective books at all. I regard myself as a novelist. My books are sometimes sold as mysteries, and they're read by people who like that sort of thing as well. But they're really books about a person who happens to be a private detective. There's no crime in them. It's really just dealing with little problems. So that really is how it developed. And I started off writing The Number One Ladies Detective Agency as a short story, with absolutely no idea at that stage that I would become a serial novelist and that it would get as big as it's become. But it did, and I'm quite happy about that.
When you began writing it, now you say you call yourself a novelist. Does that mean you have previous novels?
Yes, I was a writer principally of short stories. I wrote various collections of short stories. I'd had collections of short stories published. I read short stories for the BBC, for example, and various journals. And I was also a writer of children's books. I had about 30 children's books published before I started to write these books. So it was a rather odd writing career that I had had. But I was an active writer. And then I started on this particular series. And I proposed to do 8 of them, and then review the situation. I've written 5 so far, 4 published in the United States, 5th one has just been published in the UK, and I'm starting a new series as well next year. But it was, I suppose, a series of coincidences and unanticipated events which led me into this.
When you began writing it, you said it began as a short story and became a novel. Did you send it out to various places, or did Polygon approach you? How did that happen?
What happened was that I wrote it as a short story, just thinking that I might place it somewhere as a short story, but then I felt that I rather liked the character, and so I did a number of other stories around the same character, and then eventually ended up making it into a novel. And then it was originally going to be published by my then publishers, who'd recently done a collection of my short stories, and for one or two incidental reasons, I ended up with a different publisher for that, namely Polygon.
Alexander McCall Smith, let's talk a little about your life and your career, and relate it a little to Botswana. You were born in what was then Southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. How many years did you spend there?
I spent my childhood in Zimbabwe, a fact for which I'm eternally grateful, because although I spent that time at the tail end of the colonial period, which of course often was a very sorry and sad period in the history of various countries which had been afflicted by this, it was nonetheless a marvelous opportunity and a marvelous privilege to be brought up in Africa and to see the sights and sounds of Africa and get some of the sense of the spirituality of Africa. Now, of course, because of the social circumstances in which I was brought up, I didn't see enough of that, and I didn't obviously take enough advantage of that. But when the family returned to the UK, I was left with a sense of involvement and affection for Africa. And that was something about which I did nothing for some time. And then in 1980, I was given the opportunity to work in the University of Swaziland. There was then a joint university that was shared by Botswana, Lesotho, and Swaziland. And I went back, and I suppose I put myself in touch again with Africa, with sub-Saharan Africa, and with that particular Southern Africa in particular. And I went across to visit friends in Botswana who had been childhood friends who were then working there. He was a doctor in Botswana. And I discovered that there was this intriguing society, which in fact had been so close to where we lived. When we lived in Zimbabwe, we lived in Bulawayo, and just 50 miles down the road was the Kalahari Desert in this extraordinary country, but I'd never really got to know it. And I just fell in love with the place, went back the following year, worked there, and then went back every year thereafter on various projects that I had connected with my university work. Gradually, I suppose, I learnt more and more about the society, and I realized that this was a wonderful, extraordinary country. The moment that you arrive in Botswana, you realize you're in a good place. It's an amazing feeling. And that is how I ended up being a chronicler of a little section of Botswana.
Let's talk for a second about Botswana. First off, you're white, and you grew up in a very segregated society in Rhodesia, which is, you know, Zimbabwe. What were your feelings growing up about the segregation of the races, about all that, and how did you manage? It sounds as if you got very past it. Were you fighting that from the beginning?
No, I mean, I was a child of my time, obviously, and of my society, and I was as unaware, I suppose, as most people were of the injustices and the difficulties of colonial society. As a child, you tend to take these things for granted, so you tend to take the social order for granted, etc. And it's only obviously as an adult much later that you realize what sadnesses and suffering and difficulties were implicit in the whole social arrangement. So I think that most people who grew up in a colonial society actually have to, as adults, come to terms with their particular historical circumstances. And I think that if you do that, once you get round to doing that, and you know, some people may be lucky and do that at an earlier stage than others, once you see that in context, then you can get that sort of emotional baggage out of the way. You approach a society about which you may have been really relatively ignorant, although living there later on, you can see wonderful things. And so when I, as an adult, became involved again in a way with these African societies, I did so, I hope, with a spirit of reasonable humility about it, and realized what complex and interesting and wonderful societies in many respects they are, without wanting to romanticize things too much.
Botswana itself, let's talk about Botswana. It's one of those names like Lesotho, Swaziland, we hear about. So where exactly is it in the context of Africa, and what is its kind of history?
Well, Botswana is one of the countries which borders South Africa. South Africa is the dominant country in Southern Africa. And then around its borders, and indeed within its borders, Lesotho, which used to be called the Basutoland Protectorate, is actually totally surrounded by South Africa. But you've got various countries which have obviously been very much influenced by South Africa historically. Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Swaziland are the main countries that come to mind there. Now, Botswana was a protectorate. It was a British protectorate when Boer expansion in the 19th century was threatening various parts of Southern Africa. The British government agreed to protect some of these territories to stop that sort of that expansion. So Botswana had that particular status until 1966, when it achieved its independence, and it was then still the Bechuanaland Protectorate, and it became Botswana. And it was very, very fortunate in that it had, as its first president, a man called Seretse Khama. And Seretse Khama was a great man. We all know about Nelson Mandela these days, but Seretse Khama was an earlier example of that sort of character and quality. And he set the tone for the new state, and it's been tremendously lucky in that since independence it's been consistently democratic, the only country in Africa which can claim that. It has been very observant of the rule of law, and by and large has a very good human rights record. And as a result of that, it's been a beacon within Africa. It's a remarkable country. It's never been in debt. They've been fortunate in that they've had three large diamond mines, and they put all the money from the diamonds in the bank. They haven't squandered it. So they deserve a lot of credit. So it's a remarkable society. And if you speak to people who know a lot about Sub-Saharan Africa, they will tend to recognize that Botswana is the jewel. It really is. It's remarkable.
The capital is Moshudai?
No, that is a town which is near the capital, Machudi. The capital is Gaborone,
okay.
Which has grown quite a bit in recent years, and that's where my principal protagonist in the books lives. Mara Matswe lives in Gaborone.
The MMA is an honorific, and
yes.
How is that pronounced?
Ma. The double M rather accentuates the M sound, but I think the simplest way is just say Ma.
And Ra is for a man.
And Ra is for a man. So it's the equivalent of the French Madame and Monsieur.
That's what I figured. Her name is Precious Ramatswe, and we'll go into her in a moment. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the terrain that she lives in, which is kind of sub-desert, sort of like Southern California, maybe?
Yes. Well, I have. This is only my second visit to California, so I shouldn't really sound off about it. But I think, yes, I think you would find that rather dry landscape is fairly similar to the Botswana landscape. There is vegetation. It's not a proper desert in the sense of having sand dunes and things like that. But it's very dry, very dry landscape. Very large, flat area, I suppose most people, when talking about countries like Botswana, say Texas size. Texas seems to be the unit of measurement at the moment. And I think Botswana probably is the size of Texas, or if it isn't, it's, it must be close to it.
You're listening to an interview with Alexander McCall Smith, whose series, The Number One Ladies Detective Agency. Fourth in the series is the Kalahari Typing School for Men. Ma Ramotswe deals with many issues that we all deal with, AIDS, poverty, abortion, civil wars, the difficulties with borders. What is remarkable, I think, and why this series took on a life of its own is because we don't know what it's like to live in Africa, particularly a peaceful part of Africa.
Yes, I think that the picture that we get of Africa in what we might loosely call the West is a very, very slanted, how would one put it, one-sided picture. Because we hear about the civil wars, we hear about starvation, we hear about all the problems of government in Africa, the corruption, and so on. And most people know about that, and most people, of course, feel horrified by that, and many people can't even begin to contemplate it. So we feel that Africa is a very difficult continent, besieged by these various difficulties. And I think that that really is very unfair to Africa, because in the middle of all that, there are all these people trying to lead decent lives in very difficult circumstances. And there are various cultures in sub-Saharan Africa which are very rich and which actually have a great deal to say to us. And so that's really, I think, probably the side of life in Africa which I want to portray in these books. I'm talking about ordinary life, ordinary people who are leading good lives. And Ma Ramotswe is a believer, for example, in what she calls the traditional African values. Now, those, of course, changing, but they are important.
Ma Ramotswe has a very specific history that includes a father who left her cattle so she was able to sell it and create her agency. She was once married to a man, Note Makote.
Yes.
Got that right.
Very good.
Who is a kind of dissolute jazz musician. And she has a very strong feminist sense about her. Is that pretty common in Botswana among the women?
Yes, increasingly so. African women have, I think, begun to assert themselves rather more. And in many of the African societies, I think one has to be careful about generalizing here, but certainly in many of the societies in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think there are many women in Botswana who maybe quite quietly and discreetly adopt this particular position, but they are aware of the inequality of the past, and they are also aware of just how important is their contribution to society, and that some of them would say, I think if you ask them, I don't particularly want to enter into this too much, but I think that if you ask them whether they felt that they did more than their fair share of the work, they may well say yes. So they are resourceful and really quite admirable people. And Ma Ramotswe, I think, is typical of that sort of African lady who really is very, very good at what she does and very intuitive and very intelligent.
When Alexander McCall Smith is writing from her perspective, you must get very extremely feminist in your views. Men come across pretty poorly by and large, with the exception perhaps of J.L.B. Matakoni, her longtime fiancé.
Well, being a man myself, I am certainly quite happy to defend men, and I wouldn't want to write off all of mankind in that sense. But I do think that what I have to do as a writer, writing about a woman effectively, is to be careful to try to enter into her understanding of the world and get into her shoes. And I think if I put myself in her shoes, she would see certain negative qualities in some men, not all men. She actually likes men, and she feels that men have their place.
There's a place called the African Mall that they go to. What is the relationship of that to, say, an American mall, the kind that we would see? Is there any?
Well, there are in Gaborone. There is this funny little square of shops. which she would go to, which was historically called the African Mall, and it's not really a mall in a recognizable sense. But you would find in modern Cabrini, you'd find that there are at least two, if not three now, malls which would be very similar to an American mall. So you could go and get the echt recognizable mall as well as this collection of shops. But of course, rather less dramatic. You know, the modern malls have fewer nooks and crannies and less character than the old one that she went to.
Your books, they're not really plot-driven at all. There are multiple plots, mostly involving Mara Matsui dealing with small issues. But in among them are AIDS and abortion, as well as the fact that civil war surrounds her everywhere. These people are very aware of these issues.
And I do deal with some of the big issues, although I would want to just qualify what you said about civil war. There's no civil war in Botswana. She does talk about troubles in the rest of Africa, but certainly she lives in a peaceful society and in a peaceful country. As far as these other problems are concerned, I don't really go into them in great depth. You're right in saying that I mention them. They are there in the background, and I do refer to them, but I don't go into them in great depth because I'm mostly concerned about dealing with people who are just getting on with their day-to-day lives. One of the big tragedies, the tragedy, really, which faces Botswana is the AIDS, HIV-AIDS issue, is just very, very sad indeed. It's a terrible tragedy in sub-Saharan Africa generally, but in Botswana there's a very high rate of infection, which is extremely troubling. But I don't really talk too much about it because I think I respect the view which most people in Botswana have is that they want to get on with day-to-day life and they don't particularly want the rest of the world to see them as gravely afflicted, which is an understandable human reaction to that.
The society reminds me very much of, say, backwoods rural America in that there's a lot of old cars breaking down, there's televisions, there's radio, everything like that, but it's not quite up to date. And Kalahari Typing School, it's created because there are a bunch of broken down typewriters. There don't seem to be many computers.
I think, in fact, there probably are rather more computers than I mentioned. I tend not to talk about computers in the books because computers really aren't as romantic as typewriters. Typewriters have a certain romance to them. They look nice, they feel nice, they sound nice. Computers are obviously there, and there are lots of computers in Botswana. But I think that it's just feasible that people might still use typewriters in a funny little typing school, which hasn't quite made it into the computer age. So that's the reason for that. But I think that once they learn to type on these old typewriters, they would then be using keyboards for computers afterwards.
When you do your research, you go to Botswana. Who do you talk to?
Well, I try to talk to anybody who will talk to me. So I think you have to do that. You have to be prepared to listen to all sorts of people. So I talk to my friends there, people I know. I bring myself up to date, I suppose, and what has happened in Botswana. And generally speaking, people in Botswana are very happy to talk to you. And certainly this is something which visitors often notice, that if they get involved in a conversation with somebody, you'll get the full story, which is charming and very nice, and I think is indicative of the nice human feel to the society. So I will just keep my ears open. I do go out to visit, for example, the orphanage, which features in the books, and I go and speak to the people there and hear what's been happening in their world, and just generally listen to what people have to say.
Are any of these little stories within your books, are any of them virtually true with just the names being changed?
Yes. Some of the things that happen in these books are based on actual incidents in Botswana. For example, in one of the books, the first book, there's a description of how somebody goes to be baptized in a river and then is unfortunately eaten by a crocodile. Now, that actually possibly happened in that there was a real case, and I'd seen the papers relating to this case, the legal papers relating to this case, in which somebody had gone in at a baptism ceremony into the Limpopo River and not come out. He may unfortunately have been swept away, but he may equally have been taken by a crocodile. And some of the people in the books are real people. People come up to me in Botswana and say, oh, would you mind if we could possibly be in a future book? And I'm usually happy to oblige. If I can fit them in, I'll put them in.
What is bush tea?
Bush tea is also known as red bush tea or rooibos tea. It grows only in one part of South Africa, in the Cape Province. And you can buy it in the United States. I think it's marketed here as red bush tea. And indeed, there's a firm in California which produces something called Botswana Blossom, which is a bush tea. It is, I think, technically not a member of the tea family, but it looks like tea and it tastes like a funny sort of tea. And also, it is apparently terribly good at mopping up free radicals. Maramotswe drinks bush tea. There's a lot of tea drinking that takes place in my books, and indeed eating cake. There's cake and tea. And indeed, recently, my editor in New York, Edward Kastenmeier, asked me whether I could write a little bit more about tea, because he enjoyed reading about tea instance. And so the latest book has a chapter entirely devoted to the drinking of tea, which is very important.
Have you actually met Botswanan detectives?
No, I haven't. I've met Botswana's policemen, but I haven't actually met any private detectives, and I'm not sure if there are any private detectives. When I was there recently, a few months ago, I had an audience of Chief Lynchwey II, who was a most engaging man, and very interesting chat with him. And indeed, this conversation was being filmed by the BBC, and I asked him if there were any real private detectives in Botswana of whom he was aware. And Chief Lynchwey thought for a moment, he said, yes. Now, there was a man who set up a private detective agency, and I was very interested in this because this is the first time I'd heard of it. And I said, well, is he still here? What happened to him? And he thought for a moment, and he said, now, this man, he did set up a private detective agency, and then I think he died, so he's no longer here.
Why did you make her a detective?
By accident. I had no particular intention of doing this. It just so happened that with that original story I wrote, I'd thought that I would write about somebody who did something unusual with the money that she was left by her late father. And it just so happened that I decided on a private detective agency and had no idea that it would develop in this way.
You've been listening to an interview with Alexander McCall Smith, author of the number one ladies detective agency. The most recent is the Kalahari Typing School for Men. What's the title of the new one?
The one which will come out in the United States early next year is The Full Cupboard of Life.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.